Screw it, we're just gonna talk about comics.
Welcome to Screw It, we're just gonna talk about comics. That's comic books, everybody. This is the only podcast hosted by two brothers talking about a thing they love, and that thing happens to be comic books. I'm one of the two brothers slash hosts slash comic book fan slash kind of comedian, Kevin Hines.
I'm all that and less, Will Hines.
Hey, Will, how you doing?
I'm doing okay, you know, medium plus. How about you?
Medium. I'll put myself in medium plus too. That seems like a fine place to live.
Yeah, I don't want to overpromise.
We were supposed to start our coverage of Ed Brubaker's Catwoman this week, but we're putting it off one more week.
Because we're liars.
We like to have a schedule and then not follow it. A schedule is a nice way for us to know what we don't want to do.
Being consistent, that's a way to build an audience, which we're trying not to do.
Yeah.
We're trying to shake off those listeners who want us to do what we say.
Yeah, it's too easy to publicize and then do the thing if people are interested in it. It's much harder to publicize it, do something different that's less appealing, not publicize the thing you're going to do and see how people reel from it.
Yeah.
Although I'll have posted some point that this is what's coming, but last minute, because
you got to follow our Instagram before we're
posting it. Is that right?
That's correct. 3 days. Yes.
3 days. So, and I have not posted yet that the schedule has changed. So there you go. We're going to, instead of talking about Catwoman today, we're going to talk about Guardians of the Galaxy 3, the movie that just came out. I assume there will be spoilers. We won't get into those until after our Loose Screws segment. So if you haven't seen the movie, you can listen to Loose Screws safely.
Yeah. Speaking of which,
let's just do it. Let's launch into Loose Screws.
Yeah. Do you want to do the introduction to Loose Screws?
Sure. So Loose Screws is the classic segment, the world famous segment, where we take a jar of loose screws off of our workbench and pour a few out to talk about them. And those screws are not comic books.
Not always.
Other media that we want to talk about. Yeah, I guess it could be comic books too, but generally it means movies or TV shows and possibly comic book related or at least loosely genre related. I don't have a loose screw today, so there's only one loose screw in the jar, Will, and I think it belongs to you.
Yes. I am breaking our loose screws format a little bit because I do want to talk about comic books a little bit. I read the J.M.D. Mateus Spellbound comics.
Oh, great. So this was the thing that J.M. had come on our podcast and many other podcasts and other interviews to promote. These were comic books that he wrote with various artists, and it was all done through a Kickstarter, and then you could get single issues or a trade collection of all these various new J.M. DeMatteis stories.
Yeah.
And I backed the Kickstarter as well. I have not read my copies. They're on a shelf, but I have not read them. You've read yours.
You got print comics?
Yes, I got a trade paperback, and then they added like a new one more issue, so it's like a trade, and then like the Gloom Mysteries or something like that is an extra issue.
Yeah, the Edwin Gloom Mysteries. That's
it, yeah.
I'm going to double check that name to make sure that's right. But so I read them and I really liked them. It's very interesting to read sort of like creator-produced comic books, where JM and his business partner, whose name I forget right now, they hired the artists and... Mm-hmm.
These are legit good artists. These are guys with track records. And
yeah, these are people with great credits. The Edward Gloom Mysteries. That's what it is. Okay, yeah. So the four main titles of this initial thing, of the initial launch, are Layla in the Lands of After, Any Man, Godsend, and Wisdom. That's the order they are in the trade. Okay. And then also the bonus one, the Edward Gloom Mysteries. They each have a different artist, and I think the idea is there's a vote. Like you can vote. I voted. You could vote for which one you want to continue. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if they're going to stick to that and like only do the one that's voted for, because there also was an option to say do them all, which I did vote for. but I also ranked them in order of preference for the sake of the vote. Okay. They all have something to offer. It is really fun to read comics. You know, James DeMatteis, you know, incredible veteran and accomplished comic book writer, knows his way around telling a story. And yeah. It was really interesting to read all four of them. They all end with a bang, I noticed. Each of the issues ends strong, where I wanted to know what happened next.
Like cliffhangers or just like an interesting reveal?
An interesting reveal. Like something gets revealed at the end that I didn't see coming that makes me want to know more.
Smart.
Yeah. And then and they're each very, very different. Although they are all sort of, it's not a surprise to me that these are J.M. DeMatteis books. They're very concerned with identity and philosophy, and they're very emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, those are kind of things that he'll do a lot, right? Like I am making this up, but he would write a story about like the Flash, and the Flash like goes to church or something like that.
And that, like, sounds like a very boring story by J.M.
Well, something would happen in it, but yes. Like there'd be some theme about like the Flash considering philosophy or whatever. Okay, so the ones I connected most with are Layla in the Lands of After and Any Man. I did like all of them, but Layla in the Lands of After is the story of a girl who dies in a car accident, and she's in the afterlife. That's revealed very, very early in the story, and there's sort of a mixture of like fantastical creatures and then also people she knows from her life who have died, who are there to meet her. And it's very sweet and kind of loving and sort of kind of warmly talking about death. And it's got an artist who did stuff for Sandman, Sean McManus, which is sort of pogo, kind of like Carl Barksy, Disney-ish style, old school, yeah. Disney-ish style.
And JM and McManus did a series called I'm going to mispronounce this, but Abadazad or something like that.
Yeah.
That looked really cool. I never read it, but it always looked really cool. It was one of those books I was like, oh, I want to see that. And I don't know if it ever got collected or if it did, I missed it. So like they've worked together, and Sean's art with JM's writing has always looked really cool to me.
Yeah. So this was my favorite. It's very the juxtaposition of death, but the sweetness of it was really worked on me. I was really intrigued to know what happens. And there is a reveal at the end of the first issue, which I won't say, that got me good. That got me good.
Okay.
Then Any Man, which, you know, this is the most standard of them. This is like a superhero story.
Superheroish, yeah.
Yeah. And it's basically the premise, again, this is revealed quite early, is that there is a genetic corporation that has created a great superhero, but the trade-off is that whoever gets these powers, you die after a certain amount of time because you like use up your life force early or something.
Okay.
And so you know you're going to die, and then a new person takes over. And this is like a known thing. It's like, okay, there's going to be a new – and the hero is called Any Man, and it's going to be
– Okay.
And – and so like the corporation that does this genetic thing is interesting. And, but then there's a big reveal at the end that's like fascinating, that really surprised me, that like a villain emerges that I didn't expect, and it hooked me good. And I was almost like, I didn't want this to be my favorite because it's sort of like the most traditional of the four, but I got it. It's a good superhero story. And I really,
I mean, he's written a lot of superhero stories. He knows what he's doing.
And then the other two, Godsend, is like, there's kind of like a kind of religious, spiritual figure from another world who does good deeds, sort of superhero-ish. But we see the story from the point of view of an ordinary man who just kind of becomes fascinated with Godsend and kind of needs a spiritual reawakening in his life.
Okay.
And so, like, their paths intersect in an interesting way. And really, there's more exposition in this one. And a little – and so it kind of – it almost needs more runway than the others. And I think maybe this story is not so good for the have-one-issue taste. I think this one needed a couple issues, and you sort of had to have faith.
Yeah.
Fittingly. for this religious story.
It's too bad they just didn't do more pages. I think one of the nice things about a Kickstarter is you could be like, this story needs to be 30 pages, not 22 or whatever.
Yeah.
And you should do that, I think, more.
But the art's beautiful, and it was quite good, and I certainly would be interested to read more in Godsend. Matthew Dow Smith is the artist.
Matthew Smith is also – I mean, they're all great artists. Matthew Smith is a great one, though. Mignola-ish.
It was Mignola-ish, and it was really beautiful and compelling. And then the last one is Wisdom, which is like an Old West comic mixed with like demons and sort of like Cthulhu-ish stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And this one had – basically, an oversimplification is the more talking there was at the top of the issue, the more like captions, the less it hooked me. They're all good, but like the ones that hit me less, there was a lot more JM like telling me the mythology. It's almost like he's thought of these very rich worlds for each one, and he can't wait to like tell you about the cool stuff he's thought of it for it. But it's better, obviously, if you can just be in the middle of it and discover it as you go. And the Wisdom had the most talking, and I even kind of got confused. I was sort of like, wait, what's happening?
All right, but you are not very smart as well.
I'm not smart. I'm easily confused. Wisdom's another one where I feel like if it was spread out over a couple issues, it might be a bit more fun. And then Edward Gloom Mysteries, which is the fifth one, kind of a bonus one.
Yeah.
It's like this supernatural. It's like what if Frankenstein's monster was a good-hearted detective? And he's got a little band of supernatural helpers. And it's very sweet and tender, but this is another one where JM's like telling you about a lot of characters and a lot about the world. And so I think it needs another issue to really know what we got there. But it did seem cool. Overall, I just was just kind of in favor of the whole operation. I just was like behind Spellbound as an idea. And I was glad to read them.
Yeah, I love it when, especially, he's done a little bit of creator on stuff. He did some early stuff like Moonshadow and things like that that were sort of his own, not a Marvel DC IP, basically. But I feel like he hasn't done it as much as you would think for someone of his stature, someone of his talents.
Yeah, he's a company guy, you know, whether by choice or circumstance. That's just kind of the way his career has gone.
Been around. Maybe if he had just come onto the scene in the last 10 years, it'd be a different story, right?
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, he found success with Marvel in DC Young. So, I know he's got a lot of friends and he's had a lot of good experiences. So.
A lot of friends? Oh, yeah, yeah. Lucky.
I was just kind of behind. I like the idea of this veteran storyteller doing new things. And I absolutely would read more. And I really want to know what happens in Any Man. Like that one, I want to know what happens.
Okay. So is that your – if you could only have one second issue.
Yep, that'd be the one.
Because he's got you hooked.
Yeah, and Layla's a close second. I'm curious how Layla works out. But I was – Any Man, I was like, I got to know.
I need to get around to reading those. My stack to read is enormous at this point. And it's daunting.
Yeah. How do you manage that?
Just don't read any of them.
Yeah, do you ever just declare bankruptcy and stuff? And you're like, okay, I'm reading none of these and I'm just moving on to new stuff.
I do that a lot. Like, it's also like I read a lot of digital stuff and it's just like, I have my iPad on me. I'm just going to read what I have on my iPad instead of like getting a book, pulling it out, making sure I'm sitting someplace with light. I don't know. It's just like, so because I'm often like reading between things and just like squeezing in when I can find time to read a comic nowadays.
Yeah.
Which is. But I have all these trades because they're beautiful and they're cool and they're all stories I really love or by creators I really love or second volumes of – and it's just like, when am I going to get to it? I'm the same way with TV shows. I have a list on my phone of all the TV shows and movies I want to see.
Right.
And then the last time I needed to watch a TV show, I looked at this long list and I was like, maybe I'll watch The Great, which is on Hulu, and it's not on my list. It was not on my list. And I was like, why am I – but, you know, it's a good show and I started watching it. I'm enjoying it, but – I was like, well, this is dumb. But I like looked everything on my list and none of these are grabbing me. Whatever reason, that's why they're on the list instead of having something I watched right away. But I don't have as much time to watch TV and movies and read books as I used to. So I just want to make a list so I don't forget that this was something I wanted to see at some point.
Yeah, I go through bursts. I go through bursts where I'm incredibly productive and I'll read a ton. And then somewhere I just don't seem to get around to reading anything. Around the holidays, I do a lot. Like in December and January every year, I read a ton. I don't know why that is.
I am reading Secret Identity that you finished recently. And a friend of the pod, Alex Segura, wrote. I'm about halfway through that.
Yeah.
So I am reading. I do read a real book generally at night before I go to bed. And or if I commute into the city, I'll read on the train.
I really enjoyed Secret Identity, and I did find that to be a pretty, like, quote-unquote easy read. Like, it just kind of flows quickly, and, like, it's responsibly sort of like, here's a thing that happens, and the end of the chapter ends with a little hook and stuff like that.
Yeah. So I'm about halfway through that, so.
It's about to really kick into high gear, and I definitely want to talk to you about it when you finish.
I mean, I skip every other chapter to save time, too. So
that's, okay, that's going to really make it.
I'm confused by some points.
Yeah, it's going to be confusing for you if you do that. Well, I think that's my blue screw.
All right, let's put the jar back on the workbench.
Clunk, and now to move on to the meat of the podcast.
Yeah, this is the segment we call The Meat. A nice juicy steak.
We should have said at the beginning what this was about. Maybe we should do a cold open.
I think I did.
Okay, good.
So we're talking about Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yes, you're right.
Spoil anything until after.
That's correct.
Loose screws.
So now we're probably
we generally when we talk about movies, we talk a little bit general at first, but
let's give a hard warning when we're going to enter spoiler country.
Which I think will be pretty quick.
Yeah, pretty quick. So let's get our overall. So we're going to review Guardians of the Galaxy 3. We've both seen it.
Yeah. I want to ask you two general questions before we get into it.
Okay.
And then, is there something you wanted to say first?
Nope, I'm ready.
Well, should we say a little bit what this movie is?
Yes.
Everyone knows, right?
Let's say just in case.
Okay. This is the third movie of the Guardians of the Galaxy trilogy,
yep.
Which was directed and written by James Gunn. It's his last Marvel movie,
yep,
because he is now running DC's movie slate.
Yes.
It's a rare Marvel movie where the same guys kind of run all three of the movies. Like, that has not happened in any of the other franchises.
That's right.
And it's the Guardians of the Galaxy are Star-Lord, Peter Quill, Rocket, a raccoon, Groot, a talking tree, Gamora, the most dangerous woman in the galaxy, and Thanos is like sort of a stolen, abducted daughter that he sort of stole and made his daughter.
Yep.
Drax, the Destroyer, whose family was killed by Thanos.
And then
they sort of added in some other characters as time has gone on. Nebula and Mantis.
Right.
Have sort of become part of this team as well. Some
Nebula, Gamora's sister, basically, who's also like a cyborg assassin.
Yeah.
And then Mantis, who can change people's emotions.
Right. And so the team has grown and evolved. And this is the third movie in that just came out a few weeks ago at this point. So I don't know, mid-May, early May. And a rare movie that I saw in theaters and you've seen as well. And that's basically, I think that's the gist of what this is. And the plot. It should not be. I mean, you're either into that or not. You don't need to know what the plot is, but it's another Guardians movie, and it's central around Rocket's origins, I would say.
Yeah, this is Rocket's movie. We learn his backstory, and which is sort of told in flashbacks as we go through the current adventure.
That's right.
So, what's your relationship to Guardians going into this movie, the movies and the property?
Sure. It's good. I have a really good relationship. We're really close. I love the Guardians of the Galaxy. I loved it before the first movie. Guardians of the Galaxy were sort of created by Keith Giffen.
Yes. In the modern sensibility of them.
Yes. As you know, I'm a fan of Keith Giffen. Though he did not give them that name, which was a repurposed name from an old Len Wein, maybe? Feels like, or Bill Mantlow? I don't even know.
Len Wein is all over.
I'm guessing Len Wein just because he created everything. That's not necessarily true. The Guardians of the Galaxy. I'll
look it up
as
you say your opinion.
The Guardians of the Galaxy sort of originally was the name of like a future team that were like fighting Badoon in the future with, the our Marvel universe was dead and these guys were like the last remnants of the heroes of the galaxy or whatever. But I don't even know when this was. But around the time of like Marvel's Civil War comics were coming out, there was off in the corner these sort of cosmic stories that started with Keith Giffen and then added Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning as main writers and some great artists. And they basically told these like cosmic stories that I really liked Keith Giffen. So I checked it out because of that. But then I really got into all of it. I got really into Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning's work. And it was nice because it was two or three titles all connected. It was like a mini Marvel universe. I didn't need to read any of the other Marvel books. I could read those and I was reading the whole universe. It was very simple and cool. And within these stories, Keith Giffen tells a story about Star-Lord where he teams up with Groot and Rocket and some other people. Not Drax initially, but they sort of go on a mission together. And then that spins off into an ongoing series called The Guardians of the Galaxy, written by Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning. And I loved this series. This series was really fun. It was really good. It only ran like 20 issues. It wasn't like a huge blockbuster hit.
Okay.
And so when the movie was announced, like, hey, we're going to make a movie out of Guardians of the Galaxy. It's like, I was like, oh, great. That's a really cool series. But also, why this canceled series that nobody read?
Yeah.
And I think it was just Kevin Feige liked it.
Okay.
I think he just liked the property. On top of that, I like James Gunn. He did Slither, a movie you and I both have really enjoyed.
Yep.
He also did Super, a movie I really enjoyed. So James Gunn was like somebody I already kind of liked. I was like, oh, I like this guy's sensibility. And so he's doing this weird movie based on a property I really liked. I was very excited about it. And I thought that first movie was great, like one of the best Marvel movies.
Right.
And I liked the second one. And so I was excited for this third one. I like these characters. They've changed a lot from Keith Giffen's sort of origin of them. Like in the very first story, Star-Lord is very different. He's not like the movie Star-Lord. Groot can talk and sort of is evil. I mean, it's like very weird stories, but they've evolved and became something else in the comics. And really the only thing that changed in the movie is they really changed Star-Lord and made Drax dumber, I guess.
Yeah.
But the movie works. It's really fun. And so I liked all the property. So I was excited for this third movie. And I was really hoping James Gunn would stick the landing.
Okay. I'm just an interesting side note. I was on Wikipedia while you were talking, and Keith Giffen's name is not mentioned once.
Well, he is not, because when he started writing it, it was just a Star-Lord miniseries.
Okay.
But he wrote a story where Star-Lord teams up with Groot, Rocket, and a few other people to go on a mission. And then that team becomes, I mean, he didn't invent any of these characters, right? He did invent Rocket. He was one of the people involved in creating Rocket, I think.
Yeah.
But it was sort of like, he put them all together, and then the series was birthed, and was that first issue was written by Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning, and they called it Guardians of the Galaxy.
Okay.
But it is like one of those weird things. Like, he invented it, as far as I can tell. He invented like teaming these guys up. I don't think he put them together and going, this should be an ongoing series. I think he's like, this will be the 4-issue series I'm writing.
Yeah.
He liked Peter Quill. He had sort of worked with the character of Peter Quill, Star-Lord, a few times before that. And so he wanted to do another story with his character he liked.
Yeah.
And this Star-Lord was not like into music and pop culture and stuff like that. He was just sort of like a guy who lived in space. but he liked him as a thing to build stories around, I guess.
Yeah. Interesting.
He also is the person who like made Drax used to be this very, I don't know if you've ever seen Drax. Drax is like originally was like this guy with a big cape. Like this purple cowl. He looked more like the Hulk, I think.
Or is it a Darkseid ripoff kind of thing? No.
No, not Drax. Thanos was kind of a Darkseid ripoff.
Okay.
But like Drax was a completely different thing, and Keith Giffen completely changed him and made him look like what the movie version looks like.
Oh, interesting.
He made him like this cunning, vicious, real destroyer type character. I mean, they've made a dumber in the movie again, but like he like gave him like those arm tattoos that he has in the movies and stuff like that. He just like, he sort of gave a lot of these characters these sort of spins. He's the one that first like thought the idea of like Rocket and Groot working together, and Groot is like an old Jack Kirby villain, and Rocket is like this weird animal character from like an issue of the Hulk. And he's sort of like, oh, it'd be fun to put these two characters together. So he like did a lot of the heavy lifting, and Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning made it work. So they also deserve. It's a tough thing when you're giving people credit for creating something, it's like, where is that line, right? Like, we talked about it at some point with Winter Soldier, right?
Right.
Like, Ed Brubaker did not invent Bucky.
Yes, or the death of Bucky.
He did not invent Captain America. He did not kill Bucky. But he brought Bucky back and turned him into the Winter Soldier, but he's not credited as the creator of that character.
Right.
But he is.
He created the Winter Soldier for sure. Yes. This one's a bit more murky because it really is like a team effort. Like,
yeah,
Giffen picking up scraps and using part of the scraps as is, altering other scraps. Yeah. And then these other two guys coming in and kind of finishing the teaming of them.
Right. And using a name from another group that someone else had come up with.
Yeah. So it's really it's interesting.
Yeah.
Given the lack of Giffen's name in here almost seems deliberate. Like, did he remove himself? Did somebody else not want him on there? It just seems strange. He's barely on the Star-Lord page.
He also didn't invent that character, right? Claremont and Byrne did, maybe? I don't know who did.
It is created by, Star-Lord is credited as Steve Englehart, okay, and Steve Gann.
Okay. So they're completely wrong. Keith Giffen does not come across as a guy who like demands credit for things.
Yeah, interesting.
He's pretty humble, and he's not somebody who's like, oh, I'm not getting what I'm owed. He just seems like, he's like, yeah, whatever. I did the work.
Cut to him in a lair planning his revenge. Okay, so my relationship to these things was I knew almost nothing of the comic book. I'd heard of the name Guardians of the Galaxy. And the movie came out, and I loved it. And I was a fan of James Gunn already. And I really loved the movie, and it was refreshing, and it was like had a really distinct personality from the other Marvel movies. And it was a blast. I think I saw it twice in the theater, and it was a really good time. I enjoyed the second one. I couldn't like remember what happened in the second one. It was one of those where it didn't stick in my brain as much, but I definitely really enjoyed it. And so I was happy to see the third one. There were mixed reviews on this one. More mixed than the previous ones, I think.
Oh, interesting. I heard all universally praised for this movie when I went into it. I really liked it, but I was sort of – it reminded me of Everything Everywhere All at Once, where I'm like, oh, I really like this movie, and everyone seems to really like it. But why does everyone really – this is a weird movie.
Yes, yes.
These are weird movies that I don't think everyone should love.
So I think we're going to officially move into spoiler stuff starting now. So
well,
now,
before that, I want to ask you one other question.
Okay.
I want you just to rank – the three movies right now before we've even talked about them, just like
easy.
One, two, and three.
One, yeah. Two, and three is how I rank them.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah. How about you?
One, three, two. Two, okay, is the weakest, I think pretty significantly, though I liked two a lot.
Okay. All right, let's get into talking about it.
So yeah, so now, you know, spoilers
are going to
happen. Yeah.
So Drax is Superman.
Yeah, I mean, James Gunn just like made this a DC movie by the end. That feels like it shouldn't be allowed. When at the end, when they go, now we're the Justice League, and they fly off, I was just like, okay. Yeah, so this is basically Rocket's story. The gist of the plot of this movie is Rocket gets hurt at the beginning, and is sort of at death's door, and the team sort of has to rally to save him. It's sort of a very short version, leaving out a lot of details of what this movie is.
Right.
And in this stretch, we get flashbacks to Rocket being created, basically, by the High Evolutionary.
Yes. Yeah. Very tough scenes to watch in a lot of ways. Like, very sad sort of,
yes,
scenes.
High Evolutionary is very evil. He tortures animals and is mean about it. Isn't even like, well, we have to do this for the greater good. He sort of, it seems to not care that he's giving these animals like sentience and then talking about killing them to their face.
Yeah, there's a lot of animal stuff. Like, it's, yeah, there's a lot of like turning animals into humans through sort of like painful methods, and then they're kind of sad and trapped. And I mean, it's effective storytelling. It's very moving. It was tough. It was an interesting way to get at some hard feelings.
But I also think it's weird, right? Like, we have like a talking otter who's a big character, and like a duck in like spider legs or whatever.
And the other animals creature? In this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're like Island of Dr. Moreau. They're like morphed animals and like machines grafted onto animals.
And we also eventually go to High Evolutionary has created a counter-Earth that's populated with Annie-Men. This is all from comics, but like they go to like a bat person's house.
Yeah.
And it's like all that stuff's so weird. And honestly, before I saw the movie, I had not heard a bad thing about this movie. And I liked all this movie. So this is a weird criticism I have. I'm like, why do people like this? Is what I was thinking.
Because it's like freakier than you would expect. Sitting on a bat
person's. Yeah, it just feels too weird. Like someone to be like, ah, this is too much, is what I would expect some people to say about this movie.
Yeah.
And same thing with Everything Everywhere All at Once. Like when you get to like Hot Dog Fingers.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? People loved this movie? And I loved it.
Yeah.
But I was also like, why do other people love this movie? Right. I like weird and silly, absurd stuff. So
yeah,
I get why I like it. Anyway,
there is a lot like when they go to Counter Earth, not only is it populated by Annie Men, but also it dawns on you that this is not a utopia. Like the whole idea was that the High Evolutionary would populate an Earth with these peaceful animal creatures and it would be superior to the existing Earth. But then as the Guardians are driving around in order to try to get the thing they need to save Rocket, you see that this Earth sucks, that there's like lots of crime and corruption and people bullying each other. It is just our Earth,
but with any men.
Yeah, it's like they drive around the city and they see like drug deals and they see like kids and gangs and there's like meanness. And it's like it's no better than our Earth. Maybe it is worse, but it's like definitely no better. That's kind of like a complicated thing. Like we already have the story of Rocket, the quest to save Rocket, the kind of like some subplots like with Peter Quill trying to convince Gamora to remember their love, even though she's kind of like a past version of Gamora.
Yeah, she never lived that life. She can't remember a thing she didn't even live.
Yeah, and then we get to the High Evolutionary's sort of past as this animal manipulator and his power as a threatening villain. And then there's a planet of Annie-Men, and then the Annie-Men planet is corrupt.
And then there's also Adam Warlock.
Yeah, the golden man who's unbelievably powerful, but sort of like a child emotionally.
Yeah.
And just kind of does what his mommy says and sort of kills a lot of things, but maybe doesn't totally know what he's doing.
Yeah. A lot of moving parts, but I also think that is sort of a part of what happens in all these Guardians movies.
Yeah.
Because like the first movie has like Yondu chasing around and also Ronan, and the team isn't getting along, and sort of like, how are we gonna like
there's a
deal
lot
with
of,
all these moving parts? Second movie has that too.
Yeah, there's a complicated world surrounding the Guardians, and we sort of visit each aspect of it in each of the movies. Like there's the whole thing about the Ravagers, right?
Yes.
Which is what Peter Quill was a member of. And they're sort of like thieves and scavengers, but there's like a code of honor. And if you leave them, you're a traitor, which is what he is, sort of.
Yes. One thing I really like about these movies, similar to the last Black Panther or both Black Panther movies, is that they seem to expand the Marvel universe, the Marvel cinematic universe. They're like adding pieces. They're not just retreading on things. They're using some stuff that's come before, but it's like new planets and new concepts and new worlds and new things. And I kind of love that about it, where it's like, oh, this is all over. And it feels like it always existed. It doesn't feel like, oh, this is just a new thing that now exists. It's like, oh, there's this weird organic-y corporation place that they go to that's made of like flesh.
Yeah, like a flesh satellite sort of.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of just ideas.
It's right, packed. Which is – that's very Marvel Comics. That's very Kirby to have just like a million ideas crammed into something.
But I don't think it's always true of every Marvel movie. So it is fun when we get these movies that do that, for me at least.
Yeah. It's also like you say, it's very true to the tone of Guardians. It maintains the Guardians tone that's been established in the first two. It's a lot of humorous parts and sort of a kind of tone of bro irreverence or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So overall, did you like this movie or not like it? I can't tell.
I'm hesitant to say, but this one worked the least on me of all the Guardians movies. But I think that's more to do with Marvel fatigue. Like I sat there sort of wondering why I wasn't liking it more. I was kind of like just sort of waiting for it to be over. Mm. And I wonder if that's because I've watched just so many Marvel series and movies over the last year, I found myself most fatigued at the emotional arcs of small characters. Like, who's Yondu's protege who's taken over for him?
Kraglin.
So Kraglin is a Ravager or former Ravager or something.
And he's brother of the director also.
And he's taken possession of the mentally controlled arrow, which in Yondu's hands was this insanely powerful killing machine. And at the beginning of this movie, he's having trouble using it. And he's kind of looks like he's being made fun of and not respected, partly because he can't step up to the tasks that his mentor could.
Sure.
And by the end of the movie, he's got a big victory moment where he's able to use this weapon to fend off a lot of bad guys. And it's a really kind of fun action sequence. And I should like that. And I just was kind of like, all right, great. You can use the arrow. Like, I almost wanted to take that away and give more oxygen to like something else.
I mean, I'll say I didn't have like a big emotional reaction to that moment. It was sort of like you knew it was going there and it got there.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I like that all the characters have things to do. Like, I watched this movie and I was like, none of these characters didn't get a moment.
That's true.
Sometimes I watch these group movies and I'm like, oh, there's too many characters. And like, what was, you know, like, I think about like the Eternals, which I can barely remember, but I'm like, what, most of these characters were just sort of there to me.
I mean, I remember that was true, like in some of the Star Wars, recent Star Wars sequels, that J.J. Abrams and
like Finn
Ryan
didn't have
Johnson
enough to do.
Yeah, just like, movies. What's Finn here for, really?
And that's a smaller cast.
Yeah. So there is that thing of when you liked it.
I liked it a lot. I think
I'm glad.
I liked it almost as much as the first movie. The first movie just has the magic of discovery.
Right. It's new.
Like, you know, we've never seen this. And like, this is sort of like building on that. So it's certainly my feeling with the first two movies is the first movie is really great. There's a couple sequences in that first movie that I think are kind of boring, mostly Ronin sequences.
Okay.
The second movie, I think, is more consistent, but didn't like hit me as hard. Like, no moments got me as excited as anything in the first movie.
Right.
And this movie, some parts were really exciting to me and really fun. There was no bad parts, but it still was just lacking sort of that, like, the magic of like, oh, this works. How do they make a movie like this then? And it worked. But every character gets their moment, from Groot to Peter Quill to Gamora to Nebula to Kraglin to Cosmo. Like, they all get a moment at least. And I think that's great. That's so hard to do.
Yeah. It is very efficient that way. Like, it moves to everybody, keeps it very clear. And there's a ton of people in it. Also a ton of locations. And you mostly know the personality of the locations pretty easily.
Nebula also gets a lot of great moments for a character that sort of in the first movie is like a very small part of that first movie.
Yeah, she's become like one of my favorite characters.
And she was super cool in this movie, super great, and an important part of this movie. And like, I couldn't imagine this movie without her. Drax gets moments. And I was worried, I think when we talked about the holiday special, that Drax had just become jokes. And I was like, this movie better give him at least some moment where he's not just an idiot. And it did. It gave him a moment.
Yeah.
Was it a great moment? I don't know. But it was a good moment, and it was a satisfying moment, and it was a conclusion for his character, at least. You know, a story arc for him, where I feel like he didn't really have that much in the – not even really in the first movie, he barely had one. I mean, he had a couple moments, but, like, he sort of just become comic relief, he and Mantis, and a little too goofy at times. So I was very happy that he got moments. So I liked all that about it. It was just great to see everyone get these moments.
I think the reaction to it's mostly positive. I said there was mixed. What I mean by that, the New York Times gave it a negative review. And a couple critics are sort of just like not on board. I guess that's probably always true with superhero movies. And so many of my friends love it, for sure. I'm hearing big positive reactions from some people. And I am also hearing a handful of like, maybe that's true of every.
I saw a bad review. Someone shared a bad review before I saw it. But like, the bad review was like a terrible, one of the worst Marvel movies of all time. And they're like, I read the review. The first thing he says is he hated the first two.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, well, then, yeah, okay, then.
That does make sense.
You're not going to like the third one. Like, it's the same people. Yeah. Also, when I saw the movie, there were some teenagers outside the theater talking about it.
Yeah.
And then, like, some people were going in and some people were coming out. And so the teens were talking to each other. And they're like, "What? How is the movie?" And one of them goes, "Eh, B plus." I was like, "That sounds like a great movie." I was like, "A B plus movie?" But he was like dismissive of this B plus movie.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was very, like, the tone was very much, it's bad. The grade was B plus, which I'm like, oh, I'd be if I made a movie and someone said B plus, I'd be like, great, I made a good movie. So those were the most negative things I'd heard beforehand. My favorite part of this movie is the endings.
Okay. You say the endings.
All the characters different, okay, where they end up.
Yeah. Okay.
I think it's really satisfying. And I don't know why I'm being vague because we're spoiling so much about this movie already, but I really like that there's like three things you can do with a movie like this, right? You could kill off a major character.
Right.
And just have everyone sort of like,
Peter Quill could die or something like that.
Right.
Like Iron Man dies at the end of Infinity War.
And Endgame, yeah.
Endgame, right.
Right. Like you kill off a character like that and that's the end of the movie. It's like, oh, it's sad that this guy's dead, but we're going to go on and honor him. You could get the gang back together, right? They go off for one more, like, because Gamora is not part of the team. Like, she could rejoin the team. And certainly Gamora's plotline in particular is very interesting to me. Like, Gamora, throughout this movie, Peter Quill's like, wants her back in his life. And it would feel weird if she fell in love with him again. But I can see that happening in a movie.
Yes.
Like a movie telling the story of her, like, maybe they're not where they were, but she's like starting to love him again, is how that movie ends.
Right.
I certainly expected this movie to end with her going, well, I don't love you, but I do feel like I fit with the Guardians of the Galaxy. I want to rejoin the team.
Okay, that's what you're expecting, right?
That's what I was expecting the whole movie.
Right.
Even like in the last minutes, like when the mission is done and she's saying goodbye to them. I'm like, oh, now is she going to say she's staying? And she doesn't, which feels like a sad ending. And then you see her with like the Ravagers. And they're smiling and laughing and hugging her. And right. You're like, oh, this is her family.
Right.
Like, she is happy and she does have a satisfying end. And Peter Quill's come to terms with this. That was like a very realistic. It's weird to say realistic for a movie with like talking ducks and dogs. But
yeah,
it was like a realistic, satisfying ending for that character.
Yeah, it makes sense to what we've learned about that character. Why wouldn't she go back to where she was happy?
That Nebula wants to run nowhere, not be on the team, that Peter Quill goes back to Earth. Like, all those things felt very satisfying to me and, like, an interesting way to end the movie. Like, it is following their stories on and not just sort of saying, in the team is this ultimate fighting team in the galaxy. Like, this is the end of the story, and, like, there's a whole new Guardians now, basically.
Yeah, and it did feel earned, and it felt like they lived up to the stories. Yeah, that was cool.
So I really love that ending. I thought that was very satisfying. I did not cry, but I got close to tears once.
When?
Do you know when?
Mm.
I'm asking you. You were okay, heartless and you didn't care about this movie.
I'm heartless. I don't care about people. Mm-hmm. What would a human being have liked? When Peter Quill sees his grandfather?
No.
Okay. You didn't care about that.
I like seeing that actor again. I know that's a favorite actor of James Gunn.
How about... when Rocket says his name?
No. No. Yeah, that could be. I can see that.
When Rocket sees his friends in the afterlife?
No, that didn't make me cry. And I would have expected that too, but it did not.
Okay. When Gamora hugs Stallone and he goes, welcome home?
No, I really like that moment. That was as I said, like that was a moment where I was like, oh, what a cool ending for her character. That is a nice fit. Because all we've seen of the Ravagers, they seem sort of like by the books and just a team, like a job. But it's a family too. I like that. I like that, but I'm not crying liked it. I'll tell you because you don't know.
I don't know.
Was when the team is kind of all separated, but Rocket's alive again. Peter Quill's brought Rocket back to life. And he's on the radio with Nebula, and they hear Rocket's voice.
Yes, that was very
cool. And Nebula just has a moment of like,
he's alive.
She realizes Rocket lived. They saved Rocket. And I was like, it was.
They did it. Yeah.
That was very emotional. And I was like, oh, it's so crazy to me that Nebula is the one that got me. Nebula being so happy to hear Rocket's alive. I was like, and that was such a satisfying moment. Even though, like, watching a movie, you know they're going to save Rocket.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll die again, sacrificing himself to fight off the High Evolutionary, but he's not going to die. It's just not like, oh, we got back. It was too late. He's dead.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen. That would be very not satisfying. But like that moment was very well crafted in my mind.
That was really cool. Mm-hmm. Where do you think this ranks amongst James Gunn projects? To the Guardians trilogy as one thing.
I mean, it's got
to
be
compared to Peacemaker, Suicide Squad, Slither. What else has he done?
That's Super. Basically it. Super. I like all of those things. This is his best thing.
Yeah. Definitely his biggest thing.
It's crazy to imagine anything else, putting anything else ahead of it. It's too big and it's too successful. And I think it works. Even the parts that don't work, there's so much that does work. And it's charming and fun and it's unique and it's its own voice. And it feels like a James Gunn movie while also being a Marvel movie, which isn't always true of Marvel movies.
Right.
I like all those things. If I had to rank those things, it'd be very hard. But the Suicide Squad might be my least favorite. I love that.
Yeah.
I've watched it twice and I liked it the first time and then I loved it the second time. I sort of like had too high expectations for it, which is the only reason it would come in last. I think Super's very underrated. Slither's really fun.
Yeah.
And Peacemaker, I love Peacemaker's probably my second favorite thing he's done.
I think that's true for me too. I'm very glad that it exists and that we live in a world where we get a Guardians. And I'm glad that James Gunn got to do it because he was removed from the project because of tweets for a while.
Yeah.
And what a tragedy it would have been if he couldn't, it just would have been unnecessary.
I've read articles about that and it's all very interesting how he sort of was brought back. I'll talk about that real briefly. I'm basically recapping an article that I read like a month ago. So as expect your usual screw it. Incorrect statements throughout this, but he got fired because of some like tweets he did like whatever 20 years earlier that he had apologized for, that he had done, that were like, and they're bad tweets, like they're like jokes about pedophilia and stuff.
Yeah,
they're jokes. They're not, he's not saying like,
right, he wasn't endorsing that behavior.
They're framed as jokes. They're not these sort of things where it's like, oh, I was joking when I said that, you know. It's not like someone's like, oh, you should die, oh, I was kidding around. It's like, no, it's, these were written like a teenager's stand-up routine.
Right.
He wasn't a teenager. He was older than that. He should have known better, but it was also a different time.
Twitter was a smaller world.
And they're like, feel like, oh, they're trying to be edgy and shocking. They feel like the sort of jokes that would fit in The Preacher of comic book we talked about
a couple weeks ago. I definitely was of the camp that he did not deserve to be fired for them. And yes. Like, not that I even thought they were that great, but I'm like,
yeah,
these are not that great a sin given the context.
But it was happening at like a very heightened time for that.
That's
sort
like
of
when
stuff.
Roseanne Barr was fired from her show because of a tweet.
Yeah.
So there was I think there was a little bit of like, oh, you're going to fire the right wing person for a tweet? You got to fire this left wing person.
Right. And the light was put on those tweets because of right wing people who did not like that James Gunn posted a lot about politics.
Right.
And so they sort of re-unearthed those tweets and were like, you should fire the guy for this then. And Disney's like, you're right, we should.
Yeah.
And so they fired him. And James Gunn basically came out and was like, look, I've apologized for those before, but I'm still sorry about them. If they want to fire me over those, it's their right. I'm not mad about it. And like, he kind of said all the right things. He's like, yeah, I did these things. And if that's not good enough for you, I mean, I did those before the first movie and you knew about those for the first movie, but if you want to fire me for those, you should. And I hope the Guardians next movie is still good and blah, blah. Like, you know, he wasn't like mad. He was vindictive. He didn't cry about it. Like he didn't.
Yeah. He didn't like double down or cry. He didn't like posture himself as a victim or something.
Right. He sort of accepted that he did something wrong. And that if this is the
PR wise, he sort of handled it like a grown up, I guess you might say.
Yeah. That's the big thing, right? It's like, accept, like, yeah, I did this. I shouldn't have. Did he think he should be fired? I don't know, but that wasn't his call, and he doesn't think it should be his call. So he gets fired. The cast is furious. And like Chris Pratt is mad, and Dave Bautista is like furious. I think there's the woman who played Mantis, like heard about it while she was like at a convention and started crying on stage. Like it really shook them. But that in a, like, if he had really done something wrong, that could still be true. And he'd be like, well, sorry, guys.
Sure, sure.
You know, but I guess like behind the scenes, like Chris Pratt and some of the other cast members were like kind of going to Disney going, you got to give this guy another chance, because James Gunn had basically picked all the actors for this movie and fought for most of them. Like, they didn't want Chris Pratt for this movie. And James Gunn was like, no, he's the right guy. And he like kind of had to fight for almost everybody in this movie. Disney didn't want any of them. And so they all feel like very indebted to him. And that movie also worked. And it's a weird movie. It shouldn't work. And so they're fighting for him to come back sort of behind the scenes. Mostly Dave Bautista, I think, very vocally is demanding it. But everyone else is sort of like being quiet about it mostly and just talking to Disney and Kevin Feige. And then at some point, like when they're prepping for the movie, they're handed the script and like they're still using James Gunn's script.
Right.
And it's like, oh, that's weird, right? Like this guy, he can't direct it, but he can write it.
Yeah. And that was a sign that maybe they were going to bring it back.
Right. So then it seemed like, and like they hadn't hired a new director yet. And Kevin Feige is like, yeah, I wanted to wait a bit before we like hire somebody else. And basically, see, I think he wanted to wait and see if like
stuff calmed down.
Yeah. We could get him back.
Yeah.
And at some point, like the guy who fired him just like was slept on it. And like eventually was like, I think I made a mistake. I think I overreacted in the heat of the moment. And I want to see if I can bring him back. And they reached out to him, and James Gunn had like literally just signed to do the Suicide Squad. And like, we want you to come back. He's like, oh, I can't now. I'm making another movie when we were going to do Guardians. If you want to wait till I'm done, I can do it. Like, I can't now back out of this other project. And Marvel basically like, we'll wait. And so like it sort of just worked out very nicely that like everyone sort of did it right for the most part. Like maybe the firing was too fast, but other than that, but also I feel like if they didn't fire him, it would have simmered and stewed and grown possibly. It maybe worked better that they fired him and brought him back, or like made a big statement like, we are against this.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting that he got that second chance. It also just shows that like, yeah, canceling is a thing, but it's also like, I don't know, own it, live with it, just be a good person, and it'll work out for you anyway. You won't be canceled forever if you didn't like commit a crime.
Yeah, here's my not the least hot take on quote unquote cancel culture, which is it's a case by case basis.
Yeah.
And people are really quick to pick the example that backs up what they want to say about the whole thing. People who are cancel culture goes too far. You can find examples where it went too far. Absolutely. Or it's like, what? The right people get canceled. You can find a lot of examples of the right people getting canceled. You can find that.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like the evidence is there for whatever you want to beat a drum about.
Most of the people that have been canceled permanently, and permanently in quotes, because none of them are completely canceled, are people like Bill Cosby, who raped women.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I mean, maybe he should be, right? I don't know. Like, most of the people that have, like, really, like, Kevin Hart got canceled and couldn't host the Oscars, but still could make billion-dollar movies whenever he wants and fill arenas for stand-up and get to do everything else. He just didn't get one gig he wanted.
Right, right.
And I don't think he should have been fired for whatever. He, like, made some inappropriate joke then, too, but it's like, he didn't lose much. He lost like a hard, annoying job that would not have made him more famous. That he probably would have been like, after he did it, people would be like, hey, he did a bad job. So a lot of that, I think, is what happens with that. Anyway.
I do think not hosting the Oscars is dodging a bullet in terms of career stuff. It's like, to me, there's more to lose than to gain.
Yeah.
But if you have any amount of edge on you at all, at least. So, but I'm glad that. You know, and that tweet thing's really not been a big part of the story of Guardians 3. Like, I'm not hearing about it a lot in reviews or, like, discussion of it. I'm kind of glad.
But also, it worked out for his career, right? Because he wouldn't have done the Suicide Squad if he didn't lose Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right.
And if he didn't do the Suicide Squad, he probably wouldn't be running Disney.
Yeah, or doing
DC. Wouldn't have done Peacemaker. DC.
Right, yeah, that's right.
It really worked out great for him. The best thing he did was those tweets, is what I'm trying to say.
Everyone should tweet about pedophilia jokes right now. Mm-hmm. That's what Kevin Hines
says.
It
works out for you long term. You got to play the long game. You got to play the long game. All right. You want to take a short break and answer one or two emails?
Yeah, let's do it. All right, welcome back. I'm glad I didn't say mini episode at the top of this because I now have learned that we only do hour episodes no matter what. And now we're going to do some mail. If you want to email us, you can email us at screwitcomics@gmail.com. You can also tweet at us, screwitcomics, all your offensive jokes. We'll tell you you're doing a good job. You can follow us on Instagram, screwitcomics, and message us there. And there's always the unofficial Screw It Insta Push, where you take something from our Instagram and put it in your stories with the hashtag Screw It Insta Push. It's not official right now. It's unofficial, but you can still do it. Kevin?
Hey, Will.
What do we
got? How you doing? just starting over from scratch. So before I read emails, I'll say that on our Instagram, we posted the stuff from the episode we did with Brian, the mini episode we did with Brian, where we discussed like comics we'd recommend to people, comics that we like that most people love, comics we want adapted on our Mount Rushmore of comics, our personal Mount Rushmore.
Yes.
We got lots of responses on that stuff. It was really great. But most of it was on Instagram. So I'm not going to parse all that and sort of share it, but I really appreciated everyone sort of chiming in with like, oh, I would have recommended this book, or I love Preacher, or whatever. Some people are going, I also don't like that. And here's a book for me that fits in that category of.
Okay.
It's really interesting hearing all that stuff from people. I will say Mount Rushmore, I think the number one person people get mad at us for leaving out was Will Eisner.
Okay, yeah, I can see that.
Though my response to all those people was like, what's your four?
Yeah, who are you leaving out? Like,
and no, none of them responded to me when I would say that.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to leave out either Siegel Schuster or Bill Finger, right?
From mine, yeah.
From yours, like it would, because you can't leave out Kirby. I don't think you can leave out Jack Kirby.
Right. So for me, I would. I mean,
there's something redundant about Siegel Schuster and Finger because they're both like the gods who happen at the same time.
But Superman, you could say the same thing about Kirby and Ditko. Do I leave out Ditko to put Will Eisner in?
I could see that argument more than Kirby.
Yeah. You can't leave out Kirby, but I think you can't leave out Siegel and Schuster from my four, at least. I think they're just too important. So then it's Bill Finger, Ditko, I'm leaving out for Will Eisner. And I think Will Eisner is very important, but I don't leave out either of those guys for Will Eisner personally. Now, I'd love to hear what someone's four is with Will Eisner. I wasn't hearing those. From your four, who do you leave out? Kirby, Moore, Ditko, or Frank Miller?
So all my answers to all the questions are dumb, I got to say. Like, I re-listened to that episode and I'm just an idiot. Like, every single thing I said is dumb. So nothing I said...
Here's the rule. Someone's come to you and is like, Will Eisner gave a lot of money. He's paying for Mount Rushmore. He's got to be on here. And you're like, well, I don't have he is great. He should be on there. And like,
I think I'd leave out Frank Miller.
Frank Miller's sobbing. Listen to our podcast. He is sobbing right now. He knows Alan Moore doesn't listen to us, but Frank Miller does.
Frank Miller's a big, him and Feige.
Yeah, there are two biggest. We get a lot of mail from them. Neither wants me to read the mail, so I don't read it on the podcast. But they like write in a lot.
I would do Kirby.
Frank Ditko. Miller keeps demanding we do a Gru season, by the way.
Frank Miller wants Gru, huh?
He wants a 12-episode Gru season. I'm like, that's too many episodes.
I'd love to see a Miller reboot of Gru. I think I could picture it.
Okay, anyway.
Gru City.
Yeah. But a lot of people think Will Eisner, we've heard other names that were also left off, but it gets personal at a certain point. It's like, oh, what about this person? It's like, you know, Neil Adams, like who you even mentioned, someone's like, should be on there. It's like, yeah,
it's he's great. Completely great argument to leave Neil Adams in there for sure.
When you boil it down to four, it's really hard. For president, for presidents, it's weirdly easier.
Well, I can say
a lot of them are terrible.
But they actually did a weird choice for presidents too, right? Like it's Washington and Jefferson and then Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt. Like Teddy is not at the level of Washington.
But just when it was made.
He is iconic, I guess. Yeah. They picked but also Jefferson is not as iconic as other presidents. Like FDR is more iconic than Jefferson.
I mean, Obama is in a sense of being the first black president, if nothing else. Yeah.
Kennedy is weirdly, you know, iconic beyond his impact as president
because of his assassination,
his tragic
right.
end, and just kind of being this young, you know, he's
Nixon might be the funniest and should be
he'd
on
be
there.
The funniest choice, like the funniest Mount Rushmore would be like Millard Fillmore, Richard Nixon, you know, Gerald Ford.
I think the funniest would be three great presidents and then like Nixon or something or like Carter. Just be like, what? like something totally out of left field. Anyway, yeah, boiling things down to four is just really hard. And comic books have like probably like 30 very valid candidates.
And it's like, are you going to do Founding Fathers? Are you going to do Greatest of All Time or whatever the era? Mm-hmm. Are you going to try to represent different types of comics?
Yeah. Like if you
like, really, if you could do the Mount Rushmore of Marvel comics, that would be like easier than just like all of comics.
Definitely. Example. Marvel would be way easy, right? It'd be Stan, Kirby, Ditko, Claremont. That'd be my four off the top of my head.
Yeah. But yeah, you'd have Stan, Jack, Steve, and then I don't know who you do for the fourth. You really just need those three if you're going to do Mount Rushmore. But like,
yeah. And then like, you know, and a lot of people were also mad we left off a lot of international people. And we weren't given, like, a U.S. Mount Rushmore, so it's a very valid complaint. We didn't do enough. Zeke Norton, I'm sure, was mad it wasn't all
non-superhero people.
But, you know, it's just tough.
We also don't know the international stuff as well, so it'd be harder for us to do it. Like, when we were talking,
you mentioned Carl Barks. And it's like, oh, yeah, he would make my top four. And even though I think I love Carl Barks comics, I was like, I don't think he's in my – Carl Barks is something I came to so much later that if Carl Barks never did comics, it would not affect my love of comics.
Yeah.
But like if Bill Finger didn't exist, Batman wouldn't exist. And that would affect my love of comics.
Yes. Right. Right.
If Superman didn't exist, a lot of superheroes wouldn't exist. And that would affect my love of comics. You know, so it's like that sort of, but anyway, I really loved everyone's response, but I would say if you have a complaint, also include your top four, not out of like, because I want to say you're wrong and I'm right. Because I'm just curious.
Yeah.
We got a lot of email. I don't know how to pick which one I'm going to do. So I'm just going to pick sort of at random, Will. Let's see. John Byrne wrote us. Not that John Byrne, but the other John Byrne who's written us before.
It's not John Bourne's?
No, that he's also... We have a couple...
We have a couple of John Byrne sounding names.
That's right.
Okay.
And this one is literally spelled John Byrne, but he's not John Byrne. And he's definitely written us before. Maybe he's not John Byrne, but his email is John Byrne.
Okay.
In today's special extra long short Assistant Editors Month episode, Will acknowledged that Kevin's son was real. This shook me up and made me question the extensive canon of the series. I really hope there is a deal with Mephisto coming up to address this and make everyone happy, just like when Spider-Man did it. So we've made a continuity error, I guess, in our, I don't know. I think I liked you acknowledging my son, but.
Yeah. I didn't feel like Kevin was so into the joke where I'm like, your son's not real.
Julio Quesada emailed us. And this is thoughts on Brian's takeover episode, which, by the way, was everyone loved that episode.
It was really fun.
Brian has a hit episode, and I feel narcissistic being like, I think that was a great episode, because it's like, it's the episode where you and I get interviewed.
Yeah.
I do think it was a great episode. Anyway, Julia writes, hello, Milksops. Just finished the mini episode with Brian, and I have to say, he's my favorite Milksop now. great questions. The only thing is that he really sounds like Kevin. Anyway, I thought I could ruin your day with my thoughts on this. It didn't ruin my day. I'm happy for people to like Brian more than me. It seems common.
Jeez.
Dan Gelati also emailed us, and he sent he's a great podcast. He dressed as the Brian. Hey Brian, great podcast. I don't know where you found those two milksops to interview, but your awesome podcasting skills even made them sound interesting. I can't wait to continue to hear you single-handedly make the best comics podcast where a single brother talks about something he loves, comic books. And then he passed on a list of pronunciations.
Okay, great.
Which is great. Though I think DeMatteis is in here and it's wrong.
DeMatteis is the way JM says it, DeMatteis.
Right, but and this list is wrong. So now I don't trust this list either.
But I think JM said he changed it. I think he said he used to let people say it differently and now he's.
Okay, maybe that explains it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, I don't know. It makes me nervous about that sort of stuff. But anyway, thank you for the pronunciation list, Dan. I'll forget to reference it constantly.
What's Brevoort? I think that's the main one.
It's not on there.
Okay.
Because it's older, right? It's Byrne, Buscema, Budininsky, who I don't even know who that is, Cohen.
Bob Budininsky.
Yeah. I mean, there's people like Fudowitz. I don't know who that is. Like some of these names I don't know. Like they're not in comics anymore. But did not have an impact on me. So it's like, oh, great. I know how to pronounce that guy's name. What else do we got here? Dean Spencer emailed in because I was talking about the Sandman Mystery Theater collections and how they never all got collected. And he said last month, a Sandman Mystery Theater compendium number one was released. And the second one is due out by the end of the year. They are thick, soft covers. Not as good as an omnibus, but takes it however we can. Love ya, and Brian. I don't know if you have any omnibuses or big, thick collections, Will. How are your Sandmans collected? Do you have like the thin trades? Did you buy?
Yeah, the thin trades.
Like, so there's like three versions of collections now. There's like the original ones, which are like generally collected like six-ish, eight at most.
Yeah.
But somewhere like 5 to 8 would generally be in those collections.
Mm-hmm.
Then like, lately they've been, and then they started coming out with these like sort of ones that were like 20, 25 issues that are in there. They're pretty thick. Like the Astro City Metro books. I don't know if you've seen those. Those are pretty thick. But then they also these omnibuses, which cover like 50 issues.
Okay.
And people love these omnibuses. I don't get it. I don't know how to read them.
Too big.
I don't know where I have to like sit at a table. And like, I already can't find time to read my books. If I have to only read it when I'm sitting at a kitchen table with this giant tome opened in front of me, it's nice to have own them all. It's like, oh, good. I own these all, but I can never read them. So I don't, and I haven't seen the Sandman Mystery Theater compendium. My worry is it's too thick for me. Like the Metro books that Astro City put out are basically at the very end of what I can handle as thickness.
All right. That's a hot take.
I don't know if it's that hot. But I now I'm trying to look around for it. I don't want to buy it until I've held it in my hands.
Okay.
I'm also worried that they won't collect them all, that they'll just collect the ones that have already been collected that I have in thin trades, and then I'll just be stuck with two copies of everything. But thanks for letting me know. Another thing for me to buy. Okay, here's one. Mark D emailed us saying that we should call our mini episodes assistant editors episodes.
It's not bad.
It's not bad. Mark D then wrote a second email that's almost, it feels like he wrote it as he was thinking it out. In your assistant, which is how we do our podcast, so it's
appropriate, it's fitting,
no complaint. In your assistant editor's month episode, one of you said you thought Aunt May became the Herald of Galactus in an issue of What If. I would mention who said this, but I can't tell you two apart. I think you said that I erroneously thought that,
right?
That I thought it wasn't an issue of What If, but it wasn't a team-up issue, which is what we realized during that episode. I think you confused this with the time Aunt May was bitten by a radioactive spider. This happened in a backup story in What If 23, which came out in 1980. That is not what I was thinking about. I was thinking about the Marvel team-up issue that we covered. I just think I thought it was a What If issue.
Right.
Or maybe you were thinking about the second time Aunt May became known as Golden Oldie. This happened in the all-humor issue of What If 34, when she donned the Iron Man-type armor. Also was not what I was thinking about.
You're wrong, so maybe, writer. You're wrong.
Or maybe it was a story in that same issue where Aunt May became Ant-Man, spelled A-U-N-T, or rather the astonishing Ant-Ant. Or maybe you're thinking of the time Aunt May gained the power of Captain Universe. This happened in the Fantastic Four Roast, written by Fred Hembeck.
I remember that.
As for me, I began writing this message convinced that Aunt May became Captain Universe in the pages of What If, but I am equally wrong. So, no, I mean, I wasn't thinking about it. I remember that cover very clearly. We had that issue, and I think I just assumed it was a What If issue because it's so crazy.
Yeah.
But instead, it's an assistant editor's what Marvel team-up issue. Let's do two more. I'm grabbing these at random, so I didn't pre-pick these any out. This is an email from Trevor. Hello, Milksops. His subject is Mount Comics More. That's a great name for it.
It's really good.
Wanted to write and say I love the show. Been listening since Scott Aukerman guested on your Spidey incarnation. I really enjoyed the hour-long mini episodes. Brian's quiz episode is great, but I have to say any Mount Comics More that does not include Here We Go, Will Eisner is outrageous. It's a fun thought experiment, but obviously impossible to answer definitively.
Sure.
And Trevor, give me your four. Doesn't suggest who his four would be. I've never been a person who reads comics and thinks about how they would look being adapted to live action. I love the medium of comics. I think Kevin articulated this on the episode. There's only been one I can think of when I was reading Velvet by Ed Brubaker and Steve Epting. It's beautiful and compelling spycraft story that I recommend to everyone. Would love to see it come to life on a movie screen. I'm going to pause here in his email. I 100% agree. Velvet is by Ed Brubaker. It's the story of basically if Miss Moneypenny used to be a better spy than James Bond.
Okay.
And like retired into that position.
Okay.
And so she's like, you know, 50 or whatever and a secretary, but nobody knows that when she was 20, she was the greatest secret agent of all time. And then she gets framed for murdering maybe the current James Bond. I forget who she murders or framed for murdering. And then she's got to go on the run and prove her innocence. But she's such a great spy that like none of the James Bond types can catch her. And it's they're fun. Shocked by this because they're like, this old woman who's like, who like does the paperwork is outsmarting us. But only like, or maybe she kills M. It doesn't matter. Like, but like the point is like they're all like thrown by how good she is at this. But she's also way older and like not in shape. And it's super great. And it feels like a great movie that would be a great thing for like, I feel like there aren't enough great roles for women in their 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And this would be like, I imagine like Catherine Zeta-Jones now in the part.
Yeah.
It's like, she'd be incredible in this, I bet. Yeah. So something like that. Anyway, I think this would make a great movie. I 100% agree with Trevor. Anyway, you should read that book, Velvet. It's really good, Will.
I love Ed Brubaker. I'm going to read it in the next 2 minutes.
Great. Then he goes, very much looking forward to your Catwoman series. We keep putting it off, but we'll get to it, Trevor. I recently picked up nearly the entirety of Brubaker's run from a quarter bin. Outrageous, he says. Guess he doesn't think it should be in the quarter bin. Darwin Cook was a brilliant master of the craft who we lost far too soon. His Parker adaptions are must reads. And then he goes, P.S. And I didn't know about this. Maybe you did, Will. I really enjoy the long running bit on the George Lucas talk show with Watto and George, who have taken Improv 101 from both of us.
They've 101 with.
But they've never revealed which one of us taught which one of them.
No, they did at one point. I think you did one and I did two, I think.
Okay.
But he it might be reversed.
He makes it sound like you taught one of them 101 and I taught the other one 101.
That might be right. That's when they would do their Del Close marathon. Watto and George would do an improv set. They would talk about how we were their teachers.
Interesting. So like you had like George Lucas in your class at some point or Watto?
Yeah, right.
Which would be weirder?
Watto would be weirder because he's not a human being, uh-huh. Right?
Yeah, but George Lucas George Lucas is like
George Lucas as Connor Ratliff does him, though, would be such a funny improv scene. Yeah. Just this oblivious.
But the real George Lucas, imagine if he was just like, you showed up in class and George Lucas was sitting in a chair. Just like, hey, I got some free time.
I'm doing that for Comedy Bang Bang World behind the paywall. I did an improv class with Bobby Moynihan as Batman, John Gabris as Gino the Intern, and Christine Bullen as Myrtle McGee. So it's as if like I'm teaching an improv class and Batman is there.
Yeah. And that's a good plug.
Good plug, guys. Check out the CBB World paywall subscriber only thing if you want to hear me telling Batman how to do five things.
I think this is a good spot to end today's podcast, Will.
Hey, that's an editor. That's a good edit point. Chosen by a master improviser.
Yeah, that's what I explained to Watto in our 101 class. He didn't like editing. He always wanted scenes to go on longer, he said. He's like, there's some good stuff still there. And I'm like, Watto, edit.
George Lucas is like, I'll fix it later. I was like, no, this is it. You're not allowed to change this.
That would be. So next week, for real this time, we're going to start Catwoman. We're going to cover the trail of Catwoman and sort of an overview of the series and Brubaker in general, I guess.
Yeah, that'll be almost totally positive next episode.
Yeah, and if you have the first trade, we're covering the second story first. The second story is the trail of Catwoman. The first story in that book is Selena's big score.
Which we're doing second.
We're doing second because I think that's how it should be printed, and I'll talk about why.
All right, get ready for the Kevin Hines hot take next episode.
One person's already emailed and said they were questioned why I had it in that order, and then they've written back and said, I think you were right. So I've already been validated by one person.
Let's put
at the two.
Yeah. Let's put Keith Giffen and Mount Comics more, and let's get people to agree that Catwoman Volume 1 should be printed in that order. All right,
Keith Giffen and Comics more and Will Eisner, like, under his butt. like Keith Giffen is sitting on Will Eisner. So it's a full body Keith Giffen.
All right, everybody. All right. See you next episode.
See you then.
Bye.
Bye. Screw it, screw it. We're just gonna talk about comics.